This is the State of Things from the Triad Stage in downtown Greensboro. I'm Frank Stachow. Thank you. Harold Martin is a product of North Carolina's Triad region. Grew up in Winston-Salem during the 1960s and 70s when it was a bustling factory city, and tobacco and furniture were the cornerstones of the economy. That was part of the reason Harold went to North Carolina A&T, where he studied engineering. He also had an appreciation for A&T's place in history. It was only a few years before he enrolled that four black students from the school sat down at a segregated lunch counter and changed the course of American history. Harold graduated and returned to the Triad in 1984 when he took a job on the faculty of NCA&T. In 2009, he became the first former student at that institution to lead his alma mater, and the university has thrived under his leadership. It is now one of the top schools in the country for land-grant scholarships. Most recently, Harold Martin was named to the Ebony Power 100, a list of the most powerful African Americans in the country. It puts Harold in the company of leaders in business, entertainment, and politics, like actor Viola Davis, musician John Legend, and NBC Nightly News anchor Lester Holt. Harold Martin is the Chancellor of North Carolina A&T, a historically black university in Greensboro, and joins me now on the State of Things. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Tell me more about growing up in Winston-Salem.
Well, you know, I was fortunate growing up in Winston-Salem to have a climate with two incredible parents who were very demanding, not college educated, but very much committed to education and very much stalwart citizens in our community and expected no less of us. What many call a PK, a peaches kid. And so there were expectations of us around discipline and behavior and focus and the like. And so, but the important part of that as well is that it was not just the expectations of our family, our parents, but also that of the community. But equally as importantly, those teachers who were part of a neighborhood school where I went to school for first grade through 12th. And so there was this continuum of individuals in my life that never compromised on expectations.
And what about your expectations and the expectations with what you would do with that education? Were there opportunities for you in the Triad when you were growing up?
There were always opportunities. I mean, we were a bustling community, Winston-Salem, Greensboro, High Point, lots of great jobs in manufacturing, textile, tobacco manufacturing, if you will, furniture. Many of my friends were taking jobs, great benefits. Lots of individuals and our families, extended families, were taking jobs in these wonderful communities with longevity at that point and making sufficient funds to raise their families and send them off to college and do wonderful things in life. Very few of us at that time recognized that these jobs were going to shortly thereafter be short-lived. Mm. Many of them were just simply going to go away permanently or move offshore to places where labor costs were much less and the like. And so our communities had become so dependent on these jobs that it left us scurrying around trying to figure out better strategies for creating another new set of robust job opportunities that would create a competitive economy that would support us well into the future, if you will.
Tell us about your decision to study engineering in college.
Well, my mother and father grew up on large farms, my mother in particular, in Southern Virginia, large tobacco farm, and she would, my brother and I, be shipped off every summer when we were old enough to do anything. And I think we used to ask, why are we doing this every summer? But we later on in life realized that it was a set of key expectations she set. She wanted us to learn work ethic and discipline, what hard work meant, from her father and uncles who lived in the area, quite honestly. And she wanted to keep us out of trouble, quite honestly. And that interaction, also while we learned great work ethic and family values, we also, among those in our generation, realized, you know, this is really, really not what we want to do by any measure for the long term. But you also learn from individuals who made tools, who did things to keep the farm running. So you developed skills mechanical skills, electrical skills that were of critical value. That coupled with a great appreciation for math and science. Yeah. I did very, very well in math and science, and my teachers would tell me I did well in math and science and say, with math and science, you can do anything. And so they helped me understand the great value of the possibilities of studying engineering.
So that's one good reason to go to A&T. And tell us about this other reason, your sense of it being an important institution in history.
Well, we grew up during that window of time when neighborhoods, jobs, and institutions were segregated. And all of my experiences were growing up in that segregated experience throughout K-12. All of the educational experiences I had were in black middle and high schools and with black teachers who clearly looked at bright students and believed strongly that education was the great equalizer. And there was no exception. You were going to college. It was not an option. And so these teachers, coupled with parents' expectations, pushed you toward what they believed were very much the avenues that would lead to a better life for you. So many of my teachers were graduates of Carver, were graduates of North Carolina A&T, and they then connected me with the institution, pushed me toward the institution. My interest in engineering was a natural.
Were you involved in the movement? Because it wasn't over, and activism continued, certainly, after that sit-in.
Well, when we were growing up in Winston-Salem, the same kinds of things that were going on at A&T in the form of students' sit-ins for and social activism for creating equal rights and access to opportunities were also occurring in Winston-Salem. There were high schools and middle schools, black schools, that were perceived to be underfunded, less supported and the like, and there were activists in our communities who were similarly pushing for social change. And there were instances when my mother would ride the bus and my brother and I were the bag carriers, if you will, and we would go with her shopping every Saturday morning in downtown Winston-Salem. And you could see as you moved about in the department stores for colored only, for whites only. And as a child, you don't understand or appreciate what that really means. But a parent who would be very clear with you, this is your place. Don't abuse those expectations. Although you, like, as a child, someone tells you it's hot, don't touch. So don't drink out of that white water fountain. So, you know, you may want to try to go drink some of that water and get chided by some adult who would not take kindly to that notion. So
we're talking with North Carolina A&T Chancellor Harold Martin today on the state of things. Did you get involved then in demonstrations after? Well, no, I want to actually stay with that point because I want to examine the complexity of people in your parents' generation wanting the best for you, wanting you to move everything forward from where they were, and at the same time having to be so careful and so cautious about protecting you from a system that wasn't going to brook any argument and wanting for that system to break down and for you to be part of it. What must that have been like for them, and how did you take that on board as a child?
Well, for some reason there was not this fear that you were doing something wrong. It was what you saw on TV, it's what you saw your parents doing or neighbors doing, you saw your teachers doing, and you saw your school auditorium being the meeting place or your church being the meeting place where people came together to develop strategy about marches or demonstration. And so we were getting to an age where our school, for example, was going to be closed, and all of a sudden it was relevant to me. And so with our parents' support and that of our teachers and most of those folk you respected, suggested this is the right thing for you to be involved in.
That school is going to be closed as a result of integration. So we'll talk more about that and the complexities of that with my guest, Harold Martin. He's the chancellor of North Carolina A&T State University here in Greensboro. We'll talk more with him on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. But first, we're going to hear some music from a show now playing at Triad Stage, Beautiful Star. Let's listen. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the Triad Stage in downtown Greensboro. I'm Frank Stasio. My guest, Harold Martin, Chancellor of North Carolina A&T State University. Before the break, we were talking about your time at NCA&T when you were going to school here as an undergrad. Then you went away for a while. Tell us about where you went to pursue your postgraduate studies.
I decided to pursue a PhD in electrical engineering. And there, at the time, I was trying to make that decision. I was looking at institutions that were close enough to North Carolina because I had gotten married as an undergraduate the year before. My wife was at the time enrolled at Wake Forest Law School, and so I decided to look. I'd already been an educational experience in North Carolina. Virginia Tech was not too far away, an exceptional engineering program, and so I decided to pursue my PhD there. I went up and interacted with some exceptional people there who were had strong support in the electrical and computer engineering area, which is a strong interest for mine. And so started out there in 1976, had great experience, lots of opportunities for engagement in a variety of educational and research opportunities for me as a young a young student. And great experience. And upon completion of my degree there, I realized that the world was open, lots of possibilities. And the challenge for me was trying to decide what I wanted to go off and make money and do things that I felt were going to create opportunities for discovery and new research and innovation and the like, and lead in technologies and some industries that I had a strong interest in, or return to North Carolina, where my wife wanted to return and practice law. And so, after much discussion, we resolved that we'd come back to North Carolina. And now, when you come back to North Carolina,
forgive me, but you're discussing this with a lawyer, so absolutely. You lost, absolutely. Right? I mean,
I felt I was losing that debate, obviously. So I certainly did. And But one of the things I discovered as well, though, was there were few opportunities for someone with a PhD in engineering, and except in education. And so my former faculty members were strongly pulling to encourage me to come back as a young faculty member, ultimately which I decided to do. And still wrestling with what was best for my career at that time, came back, though, with some of the same passion that those teachers who taught me in high school, middle school and high school, and some of those same faculty members who had engaged me as an undergraduate student, many were still there. And most without the PhD. And so they were nearing the end of their careers. And so it's an interesting window of time for me as I transitioned into my young career and began to engage with students in a similar way those professors had engaged me, but probably from a very different perspective. Having recently completed my PhD at that time, I began to realize that there is so much more available to these students, and if I pushed them harder and exposed them to even more because of my own experience and exposure, who knew what the possibilities would be for them as well.
But what does this mean? It's also a very different environment. It's obviously a different environment for the triad. We had seen globalization change the economy here, so those opportunities were lost to you, in a sense, as an engineer coming back. Also, we talked about integration and the effects that it had. Certainly, we don't want segregated schools, but there was the effect of this nurturing environment, which has been the hallmark of HBCUs. Mm-hmm. That changes as well in terms of the other opportunities available to faculty and students. How did you see the role of an HBCU in that environment, in that very different environment?
Well, even in the early 80s, African-American students who were going off to college, a high percentage were still going to HBCUs. Then that went about 70-80% of such students were still going to HBCUs. And when you look at areas where the emerging opportunities were, in the late 60s, early 70s, and to the early 80s, corporate America was also just beginning to open up in more substantial ways for career opportunities for professionals, and degrees in business and accounting and engineering and the sciences, for example. And so those industries began to descend upon our university in substantial ways from all over America, especially in the Northeast, federal agencies looking for our graduates. And so to push then to create engineering curricular requirements that would expose these bright students to experiences and opportunities was a tremendous opportunity. Now, not all of them were as enthused as excited about this possibility as I was for them, for example. And so we had to start thinking about how we created requirements that would take these bright students who were coming to us from a variety of backgrounds, not as strong in math and science as they should be, and then prepare them without exception to master the math, master the science, and then pick up the engineering content so that they would then be ready for the workplace.
It's one thing to aspire to that as a faculty member, but in 2009 you became chancellor and immediately worked up a strategic plan through 2020. What was that plan?
Well, as I indicated, in the late 70s, early 80s, African-American students were still going to historically black colleges and universities. Fast forward to the turn of the century in 2000 forward, African-American students in record numbers were transitioning to majority institutions. Mm-hmm. Historically black colleges had to begin to be thinking about redefining themselves. My experiences from leading with Salem State University as a chancellor for about 6 years and then joining Erskine Bowles as president of the university system as a chief academic officer gave me an opportunity to see the university system as a whole and the role the university system played in assisting the state of North Carolina in transitioning from that skill-based skill-based economy around manufacturing, and manufacturing is still very important today, to more of a knowledge-based economy, helped me recognize that the institutions, all of them, were critical to helping to educate the citizens of North Carolina to meet the growing needs of our state. That experience, returning to North Carolina ENT then, helped me understand that we could no longer continue to focus on certain aspects of our institution. We were like any other organization. We needed to begin to change our organization to be more relevant to the needs of our region, needs of our state, and begin to absolutely compete for our most important share of those best prepared students to come to our university.
Yeah, interestingly enough, you took over in 2009. We're in the midst of a recession, and you decide to expand graduate programs.
Absolutely.
You decide to get bigger in the middle of a recession as a university. Had to be a challenging decision.
It's a big challenge. Interestingly, my first 90 days I spent talking to the business leaders of this community, I heard 2 to 3 key things. One, your university needs to help us meet the growing needs of our region. Secondly, your university needs to stop being so insular and being more open and accessible and responsive to this community. And when you take a look at our strategic plan for this university, it's framed around positioning the institution to drive research, innovation, growth, especially in areas of greatest need to our region, to our state.
So if you expand graduate programs, of course, that means more opportunities for research grant money, and that becomes self-sustaining. So
that's
that,
right,
as the university goes through its fits and starts about how it's going to fund, you're a little more independent.
We're a little more independent. We wanted to be able to take the research that we were able to accommodate from federal agencies and the like and begin to do more meaningful things with that research. Expand graduate programs, especially in areas of greatest need, STEM disciplines. We're a land-grant institution. Most land-grant institutions in America are predominantly STEM-based. Accelerate our strengths and capabilities in those areas. Recruit some of the world's brightest faculty to join the existing faculty we had. Invest in new and innovative graduate programs. Look for areas of opportunity for collaborations with our universities in this region.
Well, collaboration is important, and that gets back to the don't be so insular admonition that you got from the business world. That means a lot of partnerships, particularly with UNC Chapel Hill and others, and UNC Greensboro as well. Talk about the importance of those and why you decided to embark on those.
Well, this community, when I left Greensboro in 2000, this community, in my mind, very rarely focused on the value of having so many institutions in its community. The diversity of these institutions, the degree programs, the role they played in higher education. When I returned to this community about 10 years later, we're all of a sudden now a university community. The business community began, in my mind, to recognize the value and importance of the universities in our community, the educational programs, the research of these institutions, and looking for ways in which we take advantage of the presence of the institutions in our community. The two largest of the institutions, of course, UNCG and ENT, provided graduate education and research. And the desire was, what do we do with all this research funding? How do we extract from this research funding innovation of the faculty, patent these ideas, and then look for ways to commercialize these ideas with existing industries or spinning out industries from these patents with our faculty to start jobs in this community.
So that gets to, you know, less of a vocational focus, which had been for land-grant universities the founding purpose, right? I mean, we're going to turn people out who know how to do the business of manufacture to an information-based and entrepreneurial society, and that means different kinds of relationships, different partnerships, and different revenue streams.
Different revenue.
All of that you open up, particularly with graduate programs that bring in research dollars. But this all sounds great and like a luncheon speech anybody could make with no controversy, except there is controversy within the institution. The idea of these partnerships is a threat to some, and perhaps rightly so.
Sure.
There is an historic mission for HBCUs, and if you become mixed in with other universities, there's a chance that you might in some ways compromise that. Did you meet that kind of resistance?
Sure. There is history in America when with black high schools and middle schools, when integration became an accepted philosophical strategy in America, black elementary and middle high schools went away. Black kids were immersed amongst white kids and other ethnic groups in those new schools that were created or in white schools that existed. There was this enormous fear among African Americans, among HBCUs. If you start now opening up the institutions as historically black colleges and universities to now be more open and exposed to business leaders, engagement, and the like, we may lose those as well. There's interest potentially in closing some of the HBCUs, for example. You hear that discussion periodically. And so some of our constituency would say, our role is to do thus and so, to provide underprepared students educational opportunity, for example, because they're going to get that anywhere else. My perspective was that we needed to position a university built on the great history and traditions of producing outstanding graduates who've gone on to do extraordinary things. We could not be all things to everyone. We could not. And the best posture for the future of our university was to place it on a path of competitiveness that would sustain us well into the future. Excellence in academic programs, the competitiveness of our faculty, the quality of academic programs, the superior quality of our research, where there really is true innovation emerging from our faculty. It took time to explain that to our constituency, which I took very seriously. Now, being an alum gave me that advantage to build trust among our constituents so that delivering that message, and equally as importantly, beginning to show and demonstrate success from the competitiveness of our strategic plan for the future to be the very best institution can be, setting a very strong peer group of institutions against whom we would compete, mm-hmm. and we would share our successes and progress against that peer group of institutions so that we demonstrate with our peers and we demonstrate with our constituents that we can do this and do this very, very well.
Well, and right now, number three in the state university system in bringing in research grant money. So if everything else holds together, mission accomplished. Let me ask you this, though. You're senior vice president for academic affairs with the UNC system before this. As part of that, your job was to work very closely with the Board of Governors. Been a lot of controversy these days about the Board of Governors, particularly the way it is perceived by critics as working too much behind the scenes. How do you feel about that?
I don't disagree that our board is seeking to clearly define its role as a board. It is a board with a different ideology relative to the importance of education, and I do believe the board supports the University of North Carolina system without exception. There is a desire within this board to ensure that we address several things that I think are critical and don't disagree that they are important. That we are accountable to the citizens of North Carolina in ensuring that we are providing strengths in our academic programs, pathways for expediency for students to move toward graduation with competitive degrees so that they have meaningful opportunities for employment upon graduation.
We are talking with North Carolina A&T Chancellor Harold Martin today on the State of Things. But what about this? I mean, that obviously is the mission. Clearly, that's what any Board of Governors is designed to do and try to deliver. But can they do it in this milieu? Are you concerned that there's too much going on behind the scenes? And also some of the political fallout. We see a lot of tension now with the legislature and the appointment of Margaret Spellings now as president of the system. You've got the leadership of the legislature very concerned about her. What does that mean for you as a chancellor and for the system itself?
What it means for me as a chancellor and my colleagues, other chancellors, is a concern about the instability in leadership of the board and decision-making of the board and the role of the board, quite honestly. And we've begun to share this with President-elect Margaret Spellings so that there is and understanding that what is the expectation of the president, the role of the president, versus that of the Board of Governors, quite honestly. And quite honestly, there's some consistency in decision-making relative to setting expectations for the University of North Carolina and advocating in a substantial way with the legislature and business leaders in support of higher education and education in general for our state.
Do you think you get to that stability again, given some of the questions that have been raised by critics over her credentials? Obviously, her political credentials are sterling, given her connections. Not the kind of bona fide that we would expect necessarily or is common for a position in the academy this high. Are you concerned that she may not be able to get that kind of respect to get you the credibility you're asking or the stability you're asking for?
Certainly, that is a concern. That is a concern being raised by faculty throughout the University of North Carolina and various campuses. The Faculty Assembly for the University of North Carolina expressing those concerns as well, based on her experiences as former Secretary of State, Secretary of Education.
Yep.
Excuse me. Thank you, former Secretary of Education, and predominantly focused on K-12. And so, first, I think she's smart, and so I think she will put around her smart people who will help her. Understand the role of the University of North Carolina in higher education. And she's expecting us, as she's shared with us, individually and collectively as a group. She's going to need our help, quite honestly. And so with that openness, we are arriving at a place where we have some level of expectation of enthusiasm that this can work, without exception.
Harold Martin, great pleasure. Thank you so much for talking with us. Harold Martin is the Chancellor of North Carolina A&T State University. Just ahead, a new down-home-style production of a classic nativity story right here at Triad Stage. We'll get a little preview right now on the state of things, and then we'll be right back.
Into hate.